nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction and the chance to talk about NEMO 5 and how we augmented it to work on 2D materials, and also about some first and quite interesting results about how to tune band structures, wave functions, and the screening. Now, before I get started, I would really like to mention that this is a team effort. I have the honor to lead that team. I really enjoyed it for two reasons. It's one of the best students teams I was leading so far. And it's about a very exciting topic, 2D materials. So if you have never worked on 2D materials, you might wonder what's so exciting about them. A very trivial statement would be 2D materials are ultra-scaled, thinnest possible material. But if you look at experimental devices, you will see they are indeed single atomic, have a thickness of a monolayer of atoms or a few layers only, but they expand over micrometers in length. So you have an immense dimensional difference in these directions. You can have a few single atom physics at room temperature, though those materials are fairly stable. Of course, you have a very high surface to volume ratio. So we could even argue these materials don't actually have a volume. That gives very interesting effects. You can stack these materials by monatomic layers, which allows you to compose effective 2D materials with varying properties. And you have a larger design space than in 3D materials. Here are just some figures, what you can do with them. You can stack them, as I said, two different materials on top of each other. You can have even in the same layer different materials. And here's some multilayer graphene. Different colors here correspond to different thick graphene. The difference is indeed one atomic layer only. These materials are fairly stable, at least mechanically. You can bend them. That allowed some researchers recently to create or to propose also the idea of wearable electronics and to bend these materials to create them with piezo effects. Charged separation, like in OLEDs, you can have bendable light-emitting surfaces. These materials are fairly transparent, so it allows you to combine that with, well, windows, for instance, or windshields. You can have maybe light emitters in the windshield of a car. If you have high enough electron density, these materials can even host superconductivity. That was shown with graphene and MOS2. So there is quite a large variety of properties, but since these materials haven't been known or at least possible to fabricate them for a long time, there is still a good promise for, you know, a lot of unexplored and exciting findings to come. There's a sequence of 2D materials known already. I just list here them. Those underlined are the ones that I know have been fabricated, so there are some still only theoretically predicted, like borophene, for instance, or stannine. Of course, there are also compounds like graphene, hexagonal boronitride, or a transition metal dicalcogenides. The most prominent example of 2D materials is graphene. It was the first one that was fabricated. And, here you have a lot of interesting features. It's chemically stable, mechanically stable, since it's carbon atoms, it's biologically inert, etc. But in this presentation, I would like to focus on the transition metal dicalcogenides. We could say for one simple reason, these TMDs, as they are usually abbreviated, they have a native band gap. So they are maybe more applicable or easier to apply to electronic transport, electronic devices. Just to mention it, not to forget, of course, you can create, starting from 2D materials, systems with other dimensionalities. So you can roll not only graphene to carbon nanotubes, but also TMDs, and starting from that, then also you can get zero-dimensional crystals. Some applications that you can find in literature already of applications of transition metal dicalcogenides are phototransistors. You can have devices with a tunable photoluminescence intensity and frequency. Reason for that is that these materials are quite strain-sensitive, so you can change the band gaps comparably easily. Of course, there is transistor applications, and of course, given the fact these materials are two-dimensional and have a band gap, you can imagine a lot of exciting exciton effects. Now, when there are experiments, luckily for us theoreticians, there's always open questions coming along. Here is an experiment of a group we collaborate with in Northwestern. They looked at rectification behavior of monolayer, bilayer field effect transistors. Their important question was, what is the actual band offset between the monolayer and bilayer materials? They have done some semi-classical calculations, but still you can argue, at least at the interline, there should be quantum mechanical effects like interference and confinement. And of course, we need to model that and see whether that has an important impact. An arbitrary other, but I think also very exciting example is a supercapacitor based on molybdenum disulfide. Here, these nanosheets were restacked, and there were ions introduced between the layers. You can see these layers, these TMD layers, they are fairly corrugated, they are fringes. But still, that system hosts a very high capacitance per area. Of course, open questions here would be, what is the electrical response once you apply a field, electric field to that? Will you have different wave functions, band structures? Will you actually influence the corrugation? So there is possible also a piezoelectric effect. Maybe the system will actually significantly deform with a gate field. In that sense, you could also imagine phonon band structures will change, and the lattice structure is such. It is unfortunate that the TMD, the transition metal decarbonate devices that were fabricated so far, usually have a very low or a comparably low mobility for the electrons, at least compared to what you can find in graphene. There is a list of possible sources for this limitation, like you can scatter with various types of phonons, you can have defects, you can have this corrugation. I think there's an interesting experiment that was also comparably recently published. There, molybdenum B deselenide was grown on two different substrates, a polar substrate, silicon dioxide, and a fairly nonpolar one, this pyrrolene C. Those two different substrates have a different quality. The pyrrolene is rougher than the silicon dioxide, but still it was found that the mobility of molybdenum B deselenide on the nonpolar substrate is higher than in the polar one, and you have also a slower decay of mobility with temperature than in the silicon dioxide case. So that is indicating that a remote polar phonon sketching has a significant influence on that mobility. Of course, this is only a small list of open questions. There is a lot of other ones, like what is an ideal capping material? How efficient is the doping? How can you apply contacts, and what kind of contacts do you get? Heat transport as such is a very short term, but is opening up a lot of questions. When you have devices, you would like to compare the performance with maybe 3D materials or among the 2D ones. Reproducibility, scalability, or reliability are open and important questions for industry as well. Now, in this presentation, what I want to do is I want to give you an update what NEMO 5 can do and in order to model 2D materials. Most of these features that I'm going to present are not published yet, but they are available, so feel free to download NEMO 5 and use them. I will show you also some band structure and wave function properties of TMDs. I will show you the effective band offset between differently thick layers. You will see some results on dielectric constant. I will mention or discuss to some extent the TMD interfaces, so when you have different materials. And in the end, I will show you some ongoing NEMO 5 model developments, in particular when it's about transport. So just a few words about NEMO 5 itself. NEMO stands for Nanoelectronics Modeling. 5 is the fifth version, the fifth incarnation of this sequence of tools. This fifth version includes the capabilities of all the previous ones. And I think that's the reason why industry is very interested in this tool. So indeed, the companies you mentioned and also a few new ones are interested in that. So they're in particular, Intel is funding a good portion of our efforts, and the industrial MDs engineers, they're also coding in NEMO 5. So not just using, but also developing NEMO 5. NEMO 5 had been applied to a lot of questions, most of them in 3D materials. phonons, electrons, metals, semiconductors with a spin transport, or in quantum computing, I mean, all of that you can tackle with NEMO 5. And of course, those questions that I raised, we assess them with NEMO 5 as well. So I think the key feature that improved NEMO 5's functionality for 2D materials was to make it use maximally localized 1E functions. So what does that mean? This is here basically the flowchart, or a very high-level flowchart, of how we do our simulations. We start with ab initio calculations of a small section of the actual device, so that would be usually a homogeneous, you could say, bulk portion of 2D material. We can do that in VASP or a lot of other density functional theory codes. What we take from these calculations is a Hamiltonian and a basis set, which is an input to the 1E90 tool. And this tool is basically overlapping Bloch wave functions with an appropriately chosen phase factor so that you get localized 1E functions. So the point here of using this tool is to really get maximally localized 1E functions. Now, the point of doing that here, or the benefit of doing that, is that the Hamiltonian and the basis set that we get from that is of lower rank than of the DFT original input. So we can reduce the numerical load in this way by many orders of magnitude. And that allows us to compose device Hamiltonia in NEMO 5 and do then real Venn structure transport in, you know, whatever device performance calculations. So this is here a bit more in detail, what we do, or what we did for the results I'm going to show you. So for this presentation, we have used GGA with the functionals P of PBE. As I said, we get Hamiltonian and Bloch functions for various different TMDs. In particular, I should mention that we get the DFT calculations for the 3D periodic systems. So that is really like you have an infinite amount of layer of graphene layers or other 2D material layers. So it's periodic in all three directions. That is then put into this 1E90 tool, so we get these maximally localized 1E functions, MLWF. And out of that, we can then compose device Hamiltonia of mono or few layer systems. So it's basically relying on a transferability of this parametrization. And I will show you that it's actually intransferable. Now, when we have heterojunctions of different materials, we would have, for this parametrization, we would have three different Hamiltonia. Each of the bulk materials would get its own parametrization, and the interface itself gets solved in DFT and gets vanillarized explicitly. Sure.
I remember that some groups also included in their DFT calculations the GGA with PBE with the van der Waals
implications. Sure.
How important is that actually?
What I've seen in particular for the heat transport calculations with Tim Fischer, that's what Mark also mentioned, they are quite important for a correct spectrum. But maybe, Kuang, do you know it maybe? Correct me, please, by any means. It's after all also your work.
I think it's the normalization part that you require the interaction to the
right.
Lowest energy structure. But use the lattice constant from the experimental one.
So the relaxation would blow into the same horn that I know about. So when you do relaxation or phonon calculations, you really need the van der Waals coupling. For the electronic part, it should be fine then, once you know the structure. Does that answer your question?
So the layer-layer coupling, you feel it's less important to include the van der
Waals? I will actually, I think it's important, right? I mean, the point is, of course, the interlayer coupling is much weaker than in-plane coupling, also than when we do the vanillarization. So any small contribution to that will have an important impact. So it's important. Here are some, just to illustrate more what these Vanier functions look like, you can see here the wave functions, the basis functions for the molybdenum disulfide situation. So we have D orbitals mainly for the molybdenum and S and P orbitals for the sulfur atoms. The important part here, or the important property of the maximally localized 1E function representation, is these basis functions are orthonormal. So just like the empirical tight binding representation, which was the workhorse and the first electronic representation of NEMO 5, so just like empirical tight binding, we have here an orthogonal basis representation. I emphasize that because it's very important technically. We can basically use most of NeMo 5's features and directly use Vanier functions with them. So like sketching, transport, all of that is basically equivalent, like in-type binding. There is, however, an important drawback when we switch to the Vanier functions. That is kind of here shown in schematics. What you see here is the sparsity pattern of two Hamiltonia for the same material, namely this molybdenum D sulfide. This one here is very white. That's very sparse. So you have hardly any non-vanishing elements. That's the tight binding case. Whereas here, this is the Vanier situation. So just because you have denser Hamiltonia, the atypical NeMo 5 calculation takes, with Vanier functions, takes about four times longer than with the tight binding case. So you could ask, yeah, good, what's the point then using Vanier functions? The point is transferability of the parametrization. So what you see here are band structure calculations of NeMo 5 in red, in black, and the target or the comparison of DFT with these PBE functionals in the same graph. The first row here is with Vanier functions. The second one here is again NeMo 5, but with tight binding. So with the Vanier function parametrization, I told you we start with the bulk material. We get our parametrization in the Hamiltonian and we create monolayer or several layer systems directly from that without changing parameters. In a tight binding case, that didn't work out originally some years ago. So what the students had done is to parameterize the tight binding, to fit the tight binding parameters to meet the infinite layer system as well as mono and bilayer system. So you can see here in the tight binding case, the monolayer and the bilayer case, band structure is comparably well. There is some deviations that the students just couldn't get under control with the parameterization. But once you go then to more than more layers, you get more and more deviations. In the Vanier case, we don't see that. We believe in that sense that Vanier representation is more transferable than tight binding. There is another detail that was quite concerning to us, and that has to do with the Hamiltonian and goes into the direction what you asked. Namely, when you look at the Hamiltonian or the electronic coupling between layers, in a tight binding case, it turned out the Hamiltonian entries are of similar size as the coupling within the layer. That's, of course, contradicting the fact that van der Waals coupling should be much smaller than the covalent coupling. In the Vanier case, we did not see that. We have a difference of several orders of magnitude. So that gives us, again, more confidence. The Vanier representation is better than tight binding. Of course, that has a stronger impact when we leave the system that was really explicitly fit. So in the tight binding case, when you look at systems of real, heterojunctions, or in this case, that's actually published as an archive, you have here molybdenum D-sulfide and tungsten D-telluride. A typical approach in tight binding is when we need the coupling between different materials, we would take a linear interpolation between the bulk coupling of these materials. And that was what basically was done here. So the authors have used interlayer coupling of the two individual materials and used direct interpolation for the coupling between them. You can see here the comparison in band structure. In red, you have the DFT calculation of this interface. In black, you have then the resulting, linear interpolated tight binding one. So there are some areas where you could say, good, at least at K, there is an agreement, but you don't need to go far away in band structure to get a significant deviation. In a Vanier case, this is almost the same material. We just didn't have the time yet to do it for MOS2 and tungsten telluride. We did it here for MOS2 and tungsten selenide. But you see here, for this interface situation, we basically have hardly any deviation between DFT and the Vanier case. And that again, in spite of the fact the Vanier calculation is much faster than the DFT one, but it's slower than tight binding. Just as a status update, in NeMo 5, we have parameterized already several of those interfaces. And of course, there's more to come. So just to give you more confidence, I put here some band structure and wave function results. I think most of them are fairly well known, at least when you work on the 2D materials. If not, then maybe that might be still interesting and maybe even new. So what you see here, maybe this here is more familiar. You see here the band structure between symmetry points of monolayer MOS2. So monolayer, in that case, has a direct band gap. When you look at the conduction band, you can see here is a second valley that's at the connection line between gamma and K. In literature, there is some ambiguity, but it seems most of the people label that with Q. So that's what you can see here. That here is a contour graph of the conduction band minimum in the 2D K space. So you could say it's plotting here along that line, but however in 2D space. So you can see here, there's the gamma point. That is, of course, not the minimum of the conduction band. Here you can see the K valley, and here is the Q valley. So just in the connection line between gamma and K, as I just said. Good. So when we increase the number of layers, the situation is different. Let me swap a little bit back and forth. So when you look here at the Q and the K case, this is the monolayer case. So K here is the minimum. Then Q is the actual minimum for thicker layers. Here is then the band structure for that. Oh, by the way, here again, this is the comparison NEMO 5 with Vanier functions in black and in red the DFT case, but I guess we could have just plotted only one of them. So you see then, of course, we have an indirect band gap. So that's an important transition when you increase the number of layers. That transition happens not abruptly, but smoothly. So what you see here is the energy difference between the K valley and the Q valley is a function of number of layers. So you can see around the transition between 2 and 3 layers, there with the conduction band minimum changes to the Q valley. So why is it so important, Q or K? You will see that when we look at the wave functions of Q and K states. The Q states, this is here for the situation of quintuple layer MOS2, the Q states are fairly delocalized, whereas the K states are localized within a single layer. You can see that a bit better here. There is some degeneracy that's a numerical problem, basically. So when we apply electric field, so basically when we put the MOS2 on top of an oxide and then apply a gate field on the system, then we can lift the degeneracy at the K point, and we still get the electronic states localized in single layers at the K point. At the Q point, they are always delocalized. The same is true for the valence band. There, however, you have different symmetry points. So there, gamma is the maximum of the valence band, but K is another valley. Again, the gamma valley states, they are fairly delocalized over the total system, which again was here 5 layers. The K valley states are basically localized in a single layer. So this is important to keep in mind, because I will get back to that later when we have device results. I mean, you can imagine electronic states, whether it's valence bands or conduction band, when they're spread out, they will respond differently to gate fields than when they're localized in individual layers. So just some device results. I mentioned that we have this collaboration with the people from Northwestern. So there is this experimental device. Here was the question, what is the effective band offset between, you know, layers? I mean, 2D materials of different thickness. The first assessment we wanted to do was just to basically integrate the density of states with the Schrödinger equation. And tuning the Fermi level so that we get a constant and experimentally given doping density. So what we basically did is we probed how the density of states changes with a number of layers, and this is what we got. We did that for different materials, not just for MOS2. So here what you see on the left is the effective Fermi level for the doping of 1.5 times 10 to the 18 per cubed centimeter. So this is a different, effective Fermi level for N-type TMDs. Here it is for P-type TMDs. I think what's the first feature that might get into your eyes is we have here a kink. Again, when we switch from direct to indirect band gap, or from K-valley conduction band minimum to Q-valley conduction band minimum, The same is true for the valence band. We have here also this transition from K to gamma. So it's basically the transition from localized states to delocalized states. There you see this, the kink in the trend of the density of states with number of layers. This is this feature here. Of course, this trend here is basically an effect of the effective mass, which changes gradually with number of layers. When we had seen those oscillations, in the first moment, we believed, okay, this must be a numerical artifact. These oscillations wouldn't appear real for the moment, but it turned out it is a direct outcome of the band structure. So why is that? When we look at molybdenum B-D telluride, you can look at the degeneracy of the valence band maximum at the K and at the gamma point. So the K point always follows the number of layers that you have in your system. Well, that again has to do with the fact that the K states are localized in each individual layer. So in that sense, they have the same energy as well. The delocalized gamma states, they have a different spreading. We are not completely understanding yet how that exactly evolves. What we've seen is it seems they follow rather a bilayer spreading. So when you have an even number of layers, then you get an even number of these delocalized states into that system. When it's odd, you get only, not the maximum amount of that. The important part here, however, is the effective mass of those two valleys is different. So when you probe the density of states, how it behaves with energy, you have a different behavior. And then, which one of those valleys dominates the effective density of states depends on the relative degeneracy number. So if you have the same degeneracy numbers, then the K valley is more relevant. The gamma valley is more relevant, the delocalized one. But if it has a high degeneracy, if K has a high degeneracy, then this one is more impactful. So that gives this oscillation between even and odd layers. The amplitude of this oscillation, of course, has to decay, because once you have a ratio between N degeneracy and N plus 1, that difference decays when you increase N. Right? When N is infinity, then N and N plus 1 are identical. So that is the reason why this is a damped oscillation. Now, I asked you to keep in mind K-valley states are localized, gamma and Q-valley states are delocalized. So this turned out to be quite important when we analyzed how the band gaps change when we apply an electric field. So this is again the situation. We have our TMD, like here MOS2, well, or whatever TMD, they basically all have the same behavior in this case. When you put that on an oxide and apply a gate voltage on the bottom, so what we observe in theory and actually also in experiment, the direct band gap, so the transition between the two K valley states, that is basically independent of the applied, is changing with the gate field. But the indirect band gap between Q and gamma is fairly constant. It does not change with the gate field. Well, the explanation for that, we have to do in two steps. The direct band gap, I told you, is driven by K-valley states, which are localized. The gate field shifts then the relative energy of these individual layers. So when we say these are localized states, you could address them with an individual band gap for each individual layer. When you change the energy in each layer, you're basically detuning that effective band gap orientation, and the actual band gap, so the difference between the minimum valence, the maximum valence band, the minimum conduction band, that of course then has to shrink. The situation is more complicated in the indirect band gap case. So I told you these are delocalized states. In that sense, you could see the 2D material as a quantum well. So electron and whole wave functions are delocalized over the total system. When you apply a gate field on this quantum well, you won't have a rectangular quantum well, but you tilt it. So I basically could say the same when you look at just standard quantum well calculations, like LEDs. We have seen it there as well. You have then the electronic states, move downwards in parallel to the electric field. The Hall states do the opposite. So there you have two different and competing effects. The tilting of the quantum well gives you a shortening, you make the confinement basically stronger. The effective length that the quantum well states can expand is reducing. So that would increase the band gap. But then on the other side, since the electronic states move to the left and the Hall states move to the right, they get actually closer in energy again. And it turns out for those TMDs, these two effects are exactly compensating each other. So I think that's for me at least, it's a very interesting tuning knob. If you have tunneling or exciton applications, then I think it's a very nice thing you can play with. You know, do you want to change the band gap, the effective one, or you don't want to do that? Sure?
These two effects exactly compensate each other, what do you mean? If I try to calculate the recombination of the electron hole,
What we did is we didn't calculate that. The recombination would be an interesting effect. We surely have an overlap of the wave function, so there has to be a recombination. But what you don't see is the band gap doesn't change with the gate field. So you know the we could say the exciton energy, if this was exciton states, would just stay constant. So it's gate field independent. So you have your photoluminescence or whatever experiment you do. The intensity will change with the applied gate field because you spatially separate the holes from the electrons so that there will be a decay in the intensity when you apply the field, but the frequency won't change. So that is what Northwestern has measured, the experimentalists around Lincoln-Lohan. And yeah, luckily we see the same even just in simple band structure calculations. So that's, of course, a difference. They have exciton energies. We have here band structure energies. Yeah, the direct band gap does change. Yeah. So it's the indirect band gap that changes. Does not change. Direct changes, indirect not.
But my question in this context is, we know that the DFT calculations themselves, right, are not properly describing what we see now
right.
in these systems.
Sure.
And so my main concern always is in these multi-layer systems, do I have this quantum world system or do I have in reality little barriers in between?
Right. Yeah.
Which would cause also some localization and would change this entire picture. Now you're pointing out this in agreement. How far would you go to defend that agreement?
I don't want to defend DFT. I have my own concerns with that. And if you just look at the huge variety of DFT flavors, then just pick what number you want to reproduce and there. I think the localization and delocalization, however, is more a symmetry effect. And my supporting argument for that is we see the same behavior no matter what material we take, no matter what TMD material we take. So for phosphorine, correct me guys if James is maybe not around. I haven't seen him. Ah, here you are. So there's a different structure, and we have to still confirm it, but I'm pretty sure that we will see a different, band structure, of course, different symmetry points and different localization, delocalization effect. So I can't prove that right now. We don't have enough data, but I'm fairly sure that if you use a variety of DFT results, different band structures, different band gaps, but all following that crystal symmetry, you will still see that localization and delocalization effect. So K localized and the rest not.
I apologize, I missed the first part of the talk, but can you tell me again what level of confidence do you have that you capture with your 1D functions properly the coupling, the van der Waals coupling between different layers?
The transferability is one aspect. So just to repeat that briefly, we fit the bulk material, or we take the DFT calculation of the bulk material, reproduce very accurately the band structure of that, and then we create from that parameterization the monolayer or whatever number of layer Hamiltonia, and that band structure still agrees with the DFT one of those systems. So it's very transferable, in particular when we change the number of layers. And the second part is just a sheer size comparison of the Hamiltonian interlayer and intralayer. So there's orders of magnitude in between. But yeah, otherwise, sure, I mean, the experimental band gaps are larger than the DFT ones. So, of course, that same issue we have here as well. We can't get rid of this shortcoming. We inherit that from DFT. But also to say that, I mean, if we come up, or if we finally find a DFT version or any modeling version that gives us the correct band gap, maybe with a very high real space resolution, that would be still a good input for this vanillization. So this work that I present here is more on the after that. Sure.
So here, these are the multi-layer, at least the two-layer system. So the starting point is the indirect band gap material.
Yes.
And now you do say for the direct band gap, the K point does shrink together with the gate field. And at some point, it's going to catch up with the indirect band gap, right? And so at the transport level, what do you expect? Like for the indirect, you say it stays the same because of the two effects compensate each other. But now my direct band gap shrinks.
I don't think whether you can apply that much of a strong electric field. I don't know that. So I doubt it. I mean, of course, you start with a direct band gap with the very thin layers. Then the indirect band gap is smaller than the direct one. So sure, I understand, you know, you reduce the direct band gap. So sure, there would be a very interesting point, even just to say also that without electric fields, well, maybe I won't get there because it's just too far away, but maybe here you can see that, or, oh gosh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, where is it? Well, anyways, here it is. If you have a small energy difference between those valleys, of course, you have a very different sketching situation. Like you can, with acoustic or low energy phonons, you should be able to kick electrons from one valley to the next. So gut feeling, and we haven't calculated it yet, we are working on it. Of course, mobility, if it's phonon-driven, should be much lower here than when you go to well enough separated valleys. And yeah, indeed, if I raised the same question as you did. If we are around these points, can we get with an electric field the valleys again to match and to maybe get back to this situation? And I haven't got the positive feedback yet. Like, so the fields were too strong that we had to apply so far. But yeah, just I have to say that as well. Again, these are still preliminary results. We are working on the first publication. Hopefully it will come out in the next couple of weeks. So there's, even just from NeuFi's perspective, a huge space of questions that we will address for sure.
I think Kim wants to say she has a publication on this topic. She saw this impact, so maybe that's a paper.
That would be great. Yeah, wonderful. Very interesting. So this is, to some extent, we discussed this here already. What you see here on the upper left, these are experimental data, kindly shared with by Northwestern people, and here you see the authors. This is the effective band gap change as a function of layer thickness. So this is here for 3 layers, 4, 5, and 6 layers. It's more or less the same as a function of applied gate field. With NEO5, we can calculate that, but however, there is one important uncertainty or unknown, that's the dielectric constant in the perpendicular direction. So the more layers you add, you can imagine, the more you will have a different electrostatic response, obviously. Well, we are not yet in a situation to predict this response. Our plan will be to use random phase approximation, at least get their estimate for what the dielectric constant should be. What we have done so far is we took those experimental bandgap changes and fitted NEMO5 results with, the fitting parameter here would be the dielectric constant in that normal to the surface of those layers. With that, so far with the data we got, that's between, I mean, for layers of 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 monolayers for these systems, we got a fairly linear behavior for epsilon. There are published data, of course. That's what I put here in the background. They show these are experimental data. They have done gate capacitance measurements. You see there's a deviation in the slope here for the thinner systems, and also they saturate around the level of the value of 12. However, there have been in the 60s and 70s measurements done for the bulk, epsilon, which was 17. So in that sense, we might still have room for good agreement with experiment. And of course, there is still some uncertainty in how to interpret the experimental data. So what's the effective doping level, for instance? So there is still some uncertainty in these results. You had a question?
Yeah, is the unit EV in the
top right? This is the displacement field. So it's volt per meter. And, oh yeah, sorry, this, the vertical axis is electron volts, yes. Okay. So, I mean, that's active work. We wait for experimental data of thicker systems, so we hope to see the saturation. And again, as I say, that slope here might still change, so that's just very recent data. Of course, when experimentalists show us rectification behavior, we would like to do transport calculations. I show you here this preliminary result just to convince you at least NEMO5 is in the stage of being able doing that. There are still uncertainties. The dielectric constant, of course, is one of them. Also, uncertainties are about how we really interpret the density subatomically. We do that at the moment with Gaussian functions that meet the extension of the Van Eer functions. But we want to switch to the actual Van Eer functions as soon as possible. Also, the question about the leads will affect the IV characteristics. But at least we have seen asymmetry in the IV and some rectification behavior. Here is some comparison of published data of the density of states at the interline between mono and bilayer systems. So that is quite interesting for NEMO5 just from the methods point of view already. You need transport calculations to get the density of states for continuum systems, but you also need inelastic sketching to find interline states. So what we've done to at least confirm NEMO5 can do these kind of things, we applied on top of the DFT and Van Eer representation, a self-consistent Born calculation with the Green's function algorithm. We did that here with inelastic acoustic and optical phonon scattering, but these are, you know, fictitious phonons. Okay, so this is just to have some inelastic sketching, some dephasing. That's why, again, this is a preliminary result. We are in the process of getting in really two-dimensional phonons. Here it was 3D ones. You could consider that as maybe oxide phonons or helix, you know, substrate phonons. But in any case, what you can see is indeed we are able to find these trap states, and we indeed get then a band gap narrowing at the monolayer bilayer interface. So that as such we can qualitatively reproduce already. There are open questions for us to model that, namely how to handle that interline. Do we have to passivate that? Is sulfur, are sulfur atoms at the interline more stable than molybdenum atoms? You know, what is the actual relaxation? Then once we have that, it would be interesting to compare with temperature data. You know, so then the impact of phonons would be more clear. That gets me to the model development. So experimentalists give us a quite challenging transport situation. As such, what they do is to overlap TMD materials of different type to in some area that would be here in the center. So you have here a P-type TMD, maybe molybdenum and telluride, and here maybe an N-type, MOS2, for instance. So you have some area of overlap, and the distance between the overlap region and the actual context is comparably large. So, of course, when we have this tunneling between layers, we need quantum transport methods for that. At least, it's my opinion, maybe one can argue on this, including inelastic sketching and everything. So that's a nanoscale situation, but these distances here are easily micrometers long. That's a multiscaling problem. Fortunately, NEMO5 does support multiscaling transport models, so we can combine areas of high interest, like with a lot of quantum features, like tunneling and so forth. We can solve that with NEGF, but we can connect that to drift diffusion areas. That had been done so far only in 3D systems. For the 2D ones, we are still testing that. There is some promising results on this. Also there, we have to worry about a very careful subatomic treatment. And we could also always say screening is always a question. So this epsilon story will come up here again. Vacancies, well, these 2D materials are never grown perfectly. That's hard to understand, right? I mean, for me as a theoretician, it's really annoying. But, okay, what we can do to handle that, I mean, first of all, looking at the defect possibilities, like in MOS2, you can have one or two sulfur atoms missing at one spot, or maybe even a complete hole in that structure. You can have larger holes, so there's a variety of possible defects. What we can do is to calculate that defect situation in DFT. By removing a sulfur atom, we will, of course, have to relax the structure. We can then calculate the perturbation Hamiltonian in that system and vanillarize that. So that's not a can. We actually are in the process of doing this. once we have that total system set up, so once we have the actual Hamiltonian, the next step then is to introduce the actual defect containing structure into NEMO 5 with a reliable statistical model, and with that we can do transport calculations. We can then assess how much is the impact of defects on the mobility. So we are comparably close to that, like the sketching potential. When you just take out an atom, we have it in NEMO 5 already. Right now what comes next is the relaxation calculation. Of course, that will then have a longer range impact. That here is just almost nearest neighbor coupling only. So that would be here. Sorry, I haven't said that. This is here sketching potential of the pristine and the single sulfur missing MOS2. Corrugation. So when you have your TMD structures and put them on top of each other, they have different lattice constants. That of course means that there will be some strain field built up, and you go from your zero point into the area. It's a very weak build up because of the weak van der Waals coupling between the layers. But still, it is imaginable. It's energetically preferable for the systems to start to bend. And this fringing or bending, well, one can call it corrugation, we expect it will have an impact on mobility and transport calculations, transport results as such. Also, in this situation, just like in the defect case, we have to parameterize the fringing impact on the electronic Hamiltonian with DFT and the Vanier functions. We need a good relaxation calculation on these corrugated systems. And yeah, then with a perturbing potential and the statistical model for the corrugation, we can treat the corrugation as if it was a roughness or an alloy disorder system. So it's a sketching cell of energy that comes in. Just for those that know NHF, this is what we aim for. Yeah. It's basically, it's in the range where, you know, when you strain your MOS2, you have a change in the band gap. This would be the energy range that we talk here about. So you have fluctuations in the order of 10, 100 millielectron volts when you walk within that layer. So that is our sketching potential. So that's indeed one important impact. I think as important to that is also what is the correlation length. The longer the correlation length, the slower is this pileup or the fluctuation of the Hamiltonian. So the relative change in the Hamiltonian from one atom to the next would be much weaker in that case. So I think it's a solid answer would be it depends, right? Depending on the substrate and what material you put in and other conditions. So right now, in NEMO 5, what we have is we can create corrugated structures. That is actually a NEMO 5 picture here. And yeah, we are currently in the process of getting that Vanier Hamiltonian for these strain configurations. So once we have that, we need from experiments the statistical model for corrugation, and then we can directly assess mobilities and do real transport calculations. Phonons, I mentioned that in the beginning, are of course important, or I was very happy, let's say this way, when I saw this publication that there is evidence. It is important. We have inelastic and elastic sketching with phonons in NEMO 5 since quite a while. So far with three-dimensional phonons. So this is here just a result of the density of states for a gallium arsenide nanowire sketching with polar optical phonons. You see the blue line here would be just the density of states in a ballistic case. Of course, you would expect a van Hoff singularity. So here is a finite energy resolution. That's why it doesn't peak that much. But the more important part here is the density of states with sketching. You can see here the phonon sidebands. So since polar optical phonons, that's why it's clearly pronounced. This is just showing, yes, NEMO 5 has inelastic sketching with phonons. Polar optical phonons are insofar something I'm proud of, I guess my team as well, because that's very non-local in the sketching. That implies quite some load in numerical algorithms. I will come to that in a moment just to say it. So at the moment we are in the implementation of two-dimensional polar optical phonons as well. So that's just, there's some different formulas involved. But why is non-local sketching a problem for us, for the theory and for non-equilibrium Green's functions? Non-equilibrium Green's functions for real devices are usually solved recursively. This with the RGF algorithm, recursive Green's function algorithm. As it is known of today, this algorithm is not compatible with non-local scattering. So we can maybe do, you know, nearest neighbor sketching, but you can't go beyond. It's very unfortunate given that most of the sketching mechanisms, even roughness sketching, is non-local to a good extent. Unfortunately, if you look carefully in literature, you will find NEGF publications where non-locality is simply ignored without justifications, basically just saying due to numerical restrictions. So very fortunately, my team was able to rederive the RGF algorithm, the equations, and we actually have now a formalism that can cover non-local sketching to arbitrary extent. So when you look at Hamiltonian, including the sketching self-energy, so that would cover this non-local sketching. In standard RGF, you are limited to elements on the block tree diagonals, and we can go also into the blue areas here, and you can just extend them as much as you want. So that is a very important feature improvement in EMU5. We can do non-local sketching in real devices. For small systems, like what we did here, a tiny portion of a nanowire, you can do that with full inversion, as it is called, so everyone can do that, but that's really for tiny systems. For real devices, you need something better numerically. That gets me to my conclusion. I've shown you how NEMO5 was extended for 2D materials. I honestly believe NEMO5 is the tool for band structure and quantum transport problems in 2D materials. I believe that because we see that it is still very efficient to run EMU5 with 1E functions, but we are very close to DFT. As far as you trust DFT, of course, but well, for sure, if you have better input, we should be able to vanillaize that as well. We have seen subatomic resolutions are critical for charge self-consistent calculations, so fortunately we have that. We can treat quite reliably interfaces and interlines. We can do ballistic and incoherent transport in open 2D systems, and we have the multi-scaling features in NEMO5. The results I've shown you so far, well, I tried to convince you, maybe I convinced you that the 1E functions are really ideal for the 2D systems, so very transferable. I've shown you how band structures can be designed and tuned. The electrostatic screening is in the same way designable and tunable. You have seen electrons get actually trapped at interlines between when you have, you know, monolayer, bilayer, or in-layer systems. And we have seen so far, the defect potentials as such are fairly localized until, of course, you start with a strain. So that we assess at the moment. What will come soon is transport assessment of the mobility-limiting sketching mechanisms. We want to do that for phonons, defects, and corrugation. The screening at the interfaces will be a longer-term project. That's my gut feeling, but we will definitely work on that. And, of course, device calculations, TFETs, optical devices, anti-ambipolar IVs. That's what Northwestern is producing. And, I would like to invite everyone. If you have some simulation questions in 2D materials, whether it's band structures or transport problems, we have here on campus a really powerful tool. It's academic open source, so open source for you guys. You can have the source code or run the code, or ask me or my colleagues for help if you want to have just simulation results. There is a big team behind NEMO5. Those people here in red circles are the ones involved with 2D material. And I would like to thank the industry, in particular also Intel and TSMC for the financial support, as well as NSF. And I would like to thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much. So let's see if there are a couple of questions, and then we'll break because people have places to go, and then others may want to continue the discussion afterwards.
I think you mentioned doping earlier in the talk, mm-hmm. but is that something that's currently incorporated or that you plan to incorporate, like substitutional doping?
We have something incorporated in a sense, like any device simulator would have. You just assume a background doping, this is a gallium model basically. Without that, you wouldn't be able to do device calculations. The system would be just empty all the time. Then we have explicit charge impurity sketching. So you can go into NEMO 5 in the structure, say here is, if it was silicon, here is a phosphorus atom with whatever charge you would put there. We are currently in a process that you can do that randomly. So that will give also an impact on mobilities. You can sample that and just run often. The third way we have charge impurities is as a sketching cell of energy. So that is similar to the explicit one. You just avoid the sampling all the time. You have the statistics as an input instead of, you know, random numbers. So these are the ways we have it. But yeah, otherwise, like, what is the ionization efficiency? These kind of questions, we are not doing that. We would have to rely on DFT or other input.
So is it possible experimentally to dope these materials?
Yes.
Substitution?
Yes. Yeah, we have now just a publication out there where Professor Bob Wallace from Texas did do substitution doping and replaced half of the MOS2 layer, the top S, with nitrogen, almost entirely, and beautiful doping results on this. So yes, substitution doping can be done, different from our other low dimension systems in these systems.
I think people are still debating what doping density they need for useful device structures. Maybe y'all have kind of looked out here, but the rule of thumb as to what parts per thousand or parts per million range you would need is still kind of up in the air.
So is this like people used to go to MBE with, you would grow a layer and then you'd have an atomic plane of dopants and then you would grow more and then an atomic plane?
No. It's a remote plasma process that they were using really to knock out some of the sulfur atoms and have a more favorable bond with the nitrogen created.
Other questions?
What is the range of these Wannier functions?
Yeah, it's a very good question. As small as possible. It's basically depending on how successful that Wannier tool is really run. So you know the numbers better, but I think it's a few angstrom that you usually have, right? So 3 angstrom, 4 angstrom.
So it's a few
atoms, yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's more than that. I think the coupling is... Well, that's for which material, right? That's the point. MOS2, okay. So, yeah, I would have thought this 5 to 10 atoms is usually the range that you consider good. But, I mean, that's, again, how good is the DFT input? I guess that has an input to that, and also how well you run that Wannier tool.
So, are there other groups doing these kind of calculations? And if so, what techniques do they use?
Yeah.
The comparison with this?
I'm aware of 3 groups or 3 codes actually. 2 of them are purely ballistic, so they also run with the Wannier tool. The third one is related to NEMO 5. It's actually Omen. There, it's however limited to diagonal sketching only, where we want to do the physical one. And I don't know how Matthew Luizier treats subatomic resolutions. So that is not really told in the publications. And as I said, we see there's a really important impact. I guess it's clear, right? If you have just 3 layers in one direction, you need a subatomic resolution to have a, you know, to get the field correct in these areas.
Okay. Let's thank the speaker one more time.